broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning and welcome to the next edition of the Investor Exchange. I'm your host, Stephanie Sumner, and I'm here with the original crew. Everyone's here today. Welcome, guys.
And welcome back, Steph.
Yes, thank you.
Nice to see you back.
Nice to be back.
Thinking, guys, we need a sponsorship here, sponsored by Kenny's Coffee.
Yeah.
It's a vision every week.
Yeah, every Friday morning.
Fueling the UGC team.
Yeah.
Now, I was going to ask you guys, does anyone know how many days it is till Christmas? Any guesses?
Not enough.
Ooh, 45.
39.
You're joking.
So I hope that you've all started your Christmas shopping.
Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, right.
We sort of get over Halloween and we're straight into Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
And the races and on we go.
Yeah. Yep.
At least we don't have to shove in Thanksgiving in the middle of it.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
Like they do in the USA.
Yeah.
Kind of sounds like a nice event though.
Yeah, that was a big one. The year I was over there, Thanksgiving was really, really popular. It's significant.
I think they actually treat Thanksgiving bigger than what they do.
Christmas.
Yeah, it is very much. I guess we have Australia Day a month after Christmas, whereas they have Thanksgiving a month before Christmas.
Yep.
Yeah.
As it's a bit more relaxed, bit of a barbecue.
We're a bit more chilled about Australia
Better climate
Day.
For it.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, well, we might kick off today's session with Joel. What's on your mind this week, Joel?
Oh, a couple of things. whenever we go through
it's
a period
something.
Of... Yeah, there's always something. Mm. Whenever we go through a period of volatility, it's always interesting just to sort of see what is taking place and how the market unfolds. And look, I'm not going to actually speak too much on the market. I think everyone pretty much knows that, you know, our view here at UGC is that we expect this correction to sort of pass very shortly and, you know, probably within the next, you know, few months' time, we'll probably be somewhere up back towards where we were about 6 to 8 weeks ago. And all the signs seem to be there. The market's sort of still volatile at this point in time, carving out a bit of a bottom. We had a nice close last night or this morning on the US stock market. But you often see periods of... I think the low was actually in. Probably about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago. I think that was actually probably the low of this correction. And we've had a little bit of a rally from there, and then we've had another bit of a pullback in the last week or so, but it appears as though we're finding a little bit of strength and support around current levels, which is a good sign. But markets often go through periods of backfilling and trying to build a base before they actually recover from those corrections that we've had, similar to that over the last 6 weeks. So, you know, we might still have another 2 or 3 weeks of backfilling and up and down and you know, relatively volatile sort of conditions. But all things being equal, the signs still look very favourable for the next several months and certainly into the next sort of 12 to 18 months.
Very nice. Joel,
from a technical analysis point of view, I think what's important of the last week and the low that we've had recently is that it's not as low as the low that was 2 weeks ago.
Correct. That's right. Yeah. So far, we've seen a shallower low than 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
That's right. And that's encouraging.
Yep. So if there was to be a low that is lower than the low of 2 weeks ago, that would send a new signal. That would change the thinking. Well, not change the thinking, but just create a different situation.
It obviously increases the prospect of a deeper decline than what we've had. It doesn't necessarily mean though that it'll go significantly lower, because often what we do find is that you can sometimes get undercutting of a prior low. But I think that what we're seeing right now looks as though we're starting to see that buying come in at key levels of support, and it's bouncing nicely when it gets down to those key levels of support. So, you know, we'll have to watch this space, but certainly the underlying fundamentals and the macro outlook look quite encouraging still. And, you know, we fully expect that we'll have a recovery at, you know, sometime in the near future. On the back of that, though, I am interested in talking about the decline of GE. Now, a lot of people, you know, and this ties into to our philosophy around investment, you know, and we don't advocate going big, investing in big companies necessarily just because they're big. And we have spoken in the past about the fact that there is this false sense of security with investors, that just because they're big, well-known brand names and because they're large companies, there's this idea that they tend to be safer businesses and safer shares to invest in. Well, if you've been following the disaster that is GE, General Electric, which was at one stage 18 years ago, the biggest company in the world.
Wow.
Since that period of time, GE's shares have declined 85%, from $60 all the way down to around about $9 today.
Whoa. That's AMP-like.
It's probably, worse. Yeah, it's probably worse. And there's all sorts of turmoil going on at GE at the moment. Recently, they just sacked their CEO, John Flannery. He'd only been in the job for around about 18 months. After replacing Geoffrey Immelt, who had been in the position since legend Jack Welch was the CEO.
Yep.
Now, Jack Welch was famous for really consolidating and bringing in all of these various industrial aspects to GE. Geoffrey Immelt took it one step further and created the financial division that almost sent the company broke in the 2008 global financial crisis. And since then, GE has really struggled to reduce its debt levels. Its cash flows have come under significant pressure. Its revenues have declined by around about 35%, 40% over the last 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
Its profits are down somewhere around about 65% over the same period of time. And quite clearly, we are seeing the effects of a company that has grown through acquisition of businesses that haven't really been meshed together well to extract synergies. It is a major conglomerate, and it's done so on the back of debt. And what's become quite obvious is that some of the accounting practices of the business, in order to meet the numbers that Wall Street were expecting, you know, some of those accounting practices have come back to sort of hurt them. And in fact, there's now an SEC investigation going as far back as Jeff Welch's reign as to whether or not they were actually manipulating their share price and manipulating their earnings. Now, if you know anything about the history of Jack Welch and GE during that period of time, Jack Welch was very much famous for beating earnings by about 1 cent every time he released his results each quarter.
Just now, a little increment.
Yeah.
Sergei Bubka did that with his world records for pole vault.
And
1 centimetre.
Yeah. And what was what's actually fascinating is that Jack Welch actually explained how he did this in one of his books that he wrote after he stepped away from being the CEO of GE. And the fascinating thing is that if you were to apply what he did today, if you were to apply what he did back then, according to today's laws, it's a clear stock and earnings manipulation. Now, I think that I'm not sure what the rules were back then, but, you know, obviously that has led to a flow-on effect that has, you know, really masked the true financial position of General Electric and what was actually going on within the business. So it's interesting to see that, you know, such a major industrial powerhouse of the world that you can date it all the way back to the establishment and the creation of the light bulb.
Yeah.
Has now just fallen from grace dramatically and is now, you know, in the very real prospect of having to, at some point in time in the future, maybe even fall into bankruptcy and be restructured. Now, bankruptcy, Chapter 11 in the US is essentially administration, what we call administration here.
Yeah.
Joel, though, would you have seen these warning signs as an investor and known that this was going to happen? I mean, the warning signs sound like they were fairly clear if you're in the industry. As an amateur investor, I wouldn't really know where to look, but from your take?
So there were clear warning signs. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, look, all you had to do, and I keep coming back to this, the most important number when analysing any business is have a look at revenue. What's the trend in revenue?
But if they're manipulating it, how could you know?
Well, even with manipulated earnings, you can actually see that revenue for GE was declining as far back as 2006 from its peak in 2005. In fact, earnings and revenue in GE, 2008. So revenue with GE has been on decline progressively since 2008 and has never got better. In fact, it's declined every year except for 2014. So
you could make a lot of excuses from that time in 2008, though, because if that's coming off the GFC, well, for the first couple of years of that, every company on the stock market is going down after the financial crisis.
Sure they were. However, the GE's earned revenue peaked in 2008.
Right.
And then since 2009-10, progressively revenues started to decline as the global economy was recovering. So there's something going on. While everyone else is actually seeing sales improve on the back of a recovery from the GFC, GE's revenue was actually still declining in the face of a very strong recovery in the global economy.
Mm.
Profits have been falling also since that period of time. So look, if you just look at the numbers and you're just looking for an indication as to whether or not you should be buying this stock, don't buy anything where its revenues are declining. It's very hard to grow profits. And as an ordinary equity investor, you're investing in a business for profits. And one of the hardest things to do for a company is grow profits in the face of declining revenues, because basically you're going to have to cut costs. And that's an unsustainable business model.
Mm. Yeah.
So what about when I go to my financial advisor? Should I be watching you guys and saying, hey, don't invest in that stock if I think that it's going to fall? Or I mean, how do I work this out? How do I, as an amateur investor, work out what stocks to get into?
Well, it's okay. How do you, as an amateur investor? I mean, you obviously need to become educated.
Mm.
But there's two lines that are the most important when determining whether or not this is a company that should be actually invested in. Have a look at the very top line, which says revenue or sales. And if that is flat or declining, you just don't want to actually touch that company. And that's and that's the easiest screen. And GE would have been a huge red flag for any investor where they haven't been able to consistently grow their top line.
Can I add a point to Steph's question there? I think a lot of our listeners may not have the time or the inclination to want to learn all this stuff.
Yeah.
So in order to make a sound decision, they can outsource the knowledge or the understanding, but they can't outsource the accountability. They still need to make sound decisions for their own circumstances. So maybe they don't have to learn how to pick these stocks or how to choose the investments, but they probably do need to learn how to know who to trust.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the better question for them, is if they're not going to want to learn all this stuff, they just need to know how to pick a good advisor.
Mm. But here's a problem with what Steph is asking. Most financial advisors get their information from product providers,
mm-hmm.
and most fund managers are invested in predominantly big companies.
Mm.
So the generally accepted knowledge is that big companies are relatively safe. And that's whether you're talking about consumers or whether you are talking about advisors. So Steph, I think the message that we're trying to get out here is that our philosophy is that big companies don't necessarily mean that they are safe companies.
Mm. Yep.
And if you're one of our listeners and you're talking to an investment manager or financial advisor that says you should just invest in big blue chip companies, you need to question that philosophy, because we're saying that that philosophy is flawed.
Mm.
Yeah.
Big doesn't keep you safe. You want to focus on the quality of the business and, you know, and that essentially, and particularly stay away from companies that are carrying heavy debt loads. Okay, when in good times, companies that are carrying heavy debt loads can cover up their financial performance. They can get a nice tailwind from you know, a surge in the global economy or the local economy. But when the tide goes out, they're going to really come under pressure, because they still have to maintain those repayment levels, and yet you're going to have, you know, declining sales and declining cash flows, and it becomes that much harder to survive.
Can I ask another question, though? If there were so many people still invested in GE, why were they invested? And is that because the fund managers were giving this information over for people to stay invested in GE itself? Is that why people were in it? I mean, it crashes. But
well,
why did so many people stay?
There's some investors that will get out straight away.
Yep.
But there's other investors that can't get out straight away because there's a lot of money to be sold and they just can't physically sell that much. And then there's other investors who just don't keep their finger on the button as quickly as what others do. And by the time the share price has fallen, what, 85%?
Yeah.
Okay. But now that the company is valued at what it is today, is that a fair valuation?
Exactly.
So it's now at a heavy discount. Is it now going to recover? or is it now going to decline further?
Exactly.
And what's your take on that?
well, I don't know. That depends on the numbers.
Yeah, and look, I don't think we need to know. I mean, until we start to see the trends in the business turn around, we just stay aside from it. I mean, there's so many other stocks and investment opportunities in the market that you don't have to even try and worry about trying to figure out whether or not GE has hit a low and whether or not, you know, this is the bottom and whether or not the business is going to start to turn around now. Just wait for signs that are clearly showing up in the performance of the business and then look to get in after that.
And one more question, Louis. When you say that a lot of investors had a lot of money in there and it's hard to get out at that time, is that better that I start looking for a more boutique agency like a UGC because they've got their finger on the pulse to get out quicker?
Yeah, exactly. Very much so. The investors that can't get out quickly, the problem they have is that they have too much money invested.
Which sounds like a GE itself. It's a larger...
That's right, exactly. Okay. Because if you're... if the fund manager is managing billions of dollars under management and they might hold a $500 million position in a big company like GE, and in Australia, a big fund manager might hold $500 million of BHP shares. That you just can't liquidate that position fast enough to get out of BHP, because if they did try and sell $500 million worth of BHP shares on the market today, that would cause chaos on the market. They wouldn't be able to sell it at a fair price today because there's just not enough buyers in one day on the stock market.
Yep.
There were a lot of red flags. I mean, revenue was declining, profits were declining. But, you know, as an investor in a company and an owner of the shares, you want to also know that management have alignment with ordinary passive shareholders. Now, if you know anything about Geoffrey Immelt used to travel all around America with not one private jet, but with two private jets, because there was always a concern that if one jet broke down, that he'd need another one to fly out with.
Right? I mean, totally agree with him.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so, you know, there's excesses there. I mean, do you really think that flying around with two corporate jets isn't the best?
And how different is that philosophy to Warren Buffett's, who, when he finally got their own corporate jet, he named it the Indefensible because he always said, I can't justify the expense, but his time became so valuable with the decisions he was making that it had to go that way.
Yeah, so there's a lot of red flags. But unfortunately, GE is not the only industrial powerhouse that has found itself in a you know, let's call it a huge bag of shit. Ford and General Motors are in the same situation. Now, these are companies that just haven't learnt their lesson from the global financial crisis. So Ford today is just one notch above junk in terms of its ratings of its bonds. GE's bonds are already rated junk. These companies have not made the hard decisions to cut expenses, to cut, you know, huge pension obligations. They had an opportunity to restructure their finances when they went into bankruptcy during 2008-2009. And basically what had happened was they did a deal with the unions to protect the employees' pension plans, but they saddled themselves with more debts. And basically it was the equity holders and the other bond holders that took the haircuts, but not the pension employees. The pensions of the employees.
And are those companies getting government support at times?
And they got, purely because they got government handouts.
So if they were a smaller business, they'd be dead probably.
They should be dead already. Yeah. Or, you know, they wouldn't be. The brand of, you know, of Chevrolet and General Motors and
Chevy.
Yeah, these other, you know, and Ford. They wouldn't die. They'd just be transferred from poor owners of capital to
better managers
of capital.
Yeah.
See, that's the funny thing about bankruptcies, right? It's not that these businesses necessarily disappear and these products necessarily disappear. Bankruptcy just is a method of transferring, you know,
ownership and control.
And ownership and control from, you know, poor users of capital to prudent users of capital. And that's what should have happened. And that's why when capitalism is allowed to work, that makes the economy much more efficient because, you know, we're able to have the capital and the assets in the hands of those who are better stewards of it, which allows for more productive uses of that capital going forward.
Yep.
I'm going to go back a bit further in history. If you look at car manufacturers in the US in the 80s, early 80s, when they were under pressure from overseas manufacturing for the first time,
like Japan,
when Japan finally started hitting its real strides in manufacturing and sent the US car manufacturing into decline, they haven't learned the lessons from them about being competitive and cutting costs, but also growing revenues and being innovative.
Yeah.
So there's just an ongoing culture of not learning these lessons. Yeah. And that's where I will flag Jack Welch as someone who was ready to make rapid change. Mm-hmm. And that is one of his strengths with GE, is that he could and did make huge changes to their management and their style of doing business. Yep. Unfortunately, it didn't sound like it stuck with the company going into decline after he's left.
Well, there's a lot of speculation and banter about who actually is to blame for the decline of GE, and there's evidence to suggest that in the latter years of Jack Welch's reign, that perhaps some of those things that he did in the latter years were missteps. Immelt, you know, exacerbated those by really pumping up the GE finance line, which was basically lots of loans to consumers, and they really copped it. During the GFC off the back of that division. And I think they've really struggled to really pay down those debt burdens that they've had that have turned bad off the back of the GFC. They have sold down assets, trying to bring that leverage down. But, man, they've got $100 billion worth of net debt.
Yep.
$100 billion worth of net debt. And, and GE's stock entire market value is currently worth $100 billion, even less than that.
I think there's a lot to be said about corporate culture.
Yeah.
These businesses that have been around a long time, what is their culture? Do they have the ability to learn from their past mistakes and adapt?
Yeah.
Or do they have a track record of failing, then going into bankruptcy, and then coming out of bankruptcy thanks to government handouts or subsidies? What is that culture in the business?
That's great insight. Thanks, Joel. We'll be back after this short message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back to the Investor Exchange. We're just going to move on with our second roundtable conversation, which is Brett.
Okay. There was a heavy hitter meeting in Melbourne in the last week. So the three major regulators were all in town for a FINSIA event. So that's APRA, ASIC, and also the RBA.
Well, there's a couple of personality shakers.
Well, the part of it I was interested in was the words that the Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Guy DeBell had to say. So he was talking about how successful they'd been with the initiatives they've put in over the last few years in easing the property market. And so he's saying, you know, giving himself a pat on the back to some degree. And the one thing he highlighted was that he sees that the biggest risk to the Australian economy from tighter lending standards is not actually the impact on households, but rather on the property developers.
So
part of the reasoning behind this tightening in credit for developers of residential property that reflects how the lenders are reducing their desired exposure to dwelling construction. So obviously developers have a different form of loans than what everyday Australians do that are just getting mortgages.
Yeah.
We've been hearing from a number of different lenders and different developers over the last 6 months that the majority of the major banks are just not lending unless you've got a significant track record and relationship with them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of property developers out there, got small or medium-sized development companies that are quite successful, but they're no longer able to get the type of debt they were able to get before to build these new dwellings. And so that's starting to have a knock-on effect. The impact of that, from our perspective, comes back to the property market being, like any market, a supply-demand-driven market. Yep. And if we look at what the supply-demand factors are in property, we break them down to the supply can really only be the amount of people that want to list their property for sale and then the amount of new supply that comes onto the market. That's it. Yep. There's no other factor that can really influence supply.
Yep.
And then on the demand side, it's the population growth on one hand, but it's also the access to finance on the other. And access to finance is the one that's probably been hit the most and has impacted the demand side. So these are always being the two factors, the supply and demand, that are keeping the market in balance or dictating whether the market's sort of values are growing or declining.
Yep.
And one of the things I thought was interesting, if you look at it from the perspective of the changing shape of Australia's population, there's a chart here that shows if we go back to 1997, the majority of Australia's migration, where do you think it came from in terms of overseas migration?
UK.
Yep. 13, that was the bulk of it, followed by China and then South Africa. Okay, if we fast forward 2001, still the UK leading South Africa.
India?
Okay, it doesn't... Until 2003, India takes second place, but still a long way behind the UK. Skip forward a bit more. 2006, UK still leads the way in terms of most migration.
Wow.
2009, still the UK. Right. Now, in 2010, you can see the gap's closing.
Yeah.
And it's still the UK, but only slightly ahead of China and then India. Mm. So the shift is coming. Mm. Now, that was probably around the time that we're coming out of the GFC and the construction boom in property started to happen, with a lot of the high-density dwellings starting to come about.
Wait, hang on. I read the Herald Sun, and I thought it was all African gangs.
Yeah, that's they're in the outer suburbs, but there's not a whole lot of them.
Right, okay. Yeah. Thanks.
So if I look down, I'm not seeing... No, they don't even rate a mention in the top 10 countries of where it's coming from.
Oh, very good.
Okay, well, so the first year that UK were knocked off top spot from Australia's net migration was 2011, when China took over.
2011,
yeah.
Right.
And India were then in third place. So a pretty closely run race by those three.
Yep.
And so since then... India have then taken the lead, and by quite a fair way, and the UK are dropping back to third behind India and China, but the numbers are significantly higher, and that's pretty much been the case for the last 4 or 5 years.
So India is now leading the way in terms of net migration?
Net migration, yep. And followed by China, and then the UK, and then we have the Philippines, Pakistan, Vietnam, etc.
Yeah.
So we have migration from a family perspective, we have migration from a skilled workers immigration, and then there's humanitarian.
Yeah.
So those that are being allowed into our borders, refugees and the like.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so that's only a very small portion. But in terms of, so it's the skilled migration that's become the biggest portion of that. And the majority of that is coming out of India. So there's a lot of educated, trained people coming out of India that are able to come over here and get jobs. Now, the thing I thought was interesting, when you look at those two countries leading the way with migration, they're highly densely populated countries typically. So there's a culture there of living in dense cities and small dwellings.
Mm-hmm.
So it tends to make sense if I'm a developer that if I'm going to create stock for a growing population, what sort of stock would I want to build?
Well, you'd be units.
You would, wouldn't you?
High-rise.
Yeah, yeah. And so you can sort of see with the change of population from 2011 through to now, being based from those two countries, the majority of dwelling approvals and the majority of buildings we're seeing going on is high-density apartments.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, if I'm in business, I want to meet the market. I want to sell what they want. Okay. But the issue that I'm now starting to see wash through is that there's starting to become some... second generation of those migrants, and they're also, having been here for a while, they're starting to become wealthier, and they're starting to be a bit more westernized in their thinking, and they're starting to see the attraction of having bigger dwellings and moving out.
Right.
So a lot of, you know, what we were catering for is starting to shift. So that's where we're seeing a lot of the gloom and doom that people are talking about in property declines. The majority of it is in the high density apartment sector.
I would have just thought, though, that as migration increases, you know, the new lot of people would be taking, you know, the units and the high rises, and people, as you said, get wealthier and they take the dwellings that are further out or the house.
Yeah, but I think they're also finding that a lot of the time when people are coming from a foreign country, there's already communities here that they're sounding out and they're getting guidance from. They'll go and live in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look around Melbourne, there's definitely areas of the city that that have, you know, more Vietnamese, more Indian, more Chinese. So they sort of, you know, before they move here, they're probably sounding that out through their family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's starting to happen. Thought that was an interesting bit of information because it's linked with some other data that came out recently. 30% of new apartments settling in both Sydney and Melbourne are settling at below their contract price in terms of valuation. Valuations are coming in short.
30%.
30%. Wow. Yeah. So that's where it's having an impact, because, you know, if you bought off the plan 2 years, 3 years ago, and it took a while for that dwelling to be built, you as a purchaser are probably going to end up short in terms of how much the bank will lend you, and you've got to find that money yourself.
Yeah.
And that's where the risk of people not being able to settle comes about. That stock then needs to come back onto the market. If there's a high volume of that, the prices are going to decline, and that's what's the impact on dwelling prices, mainly in the high density area.
In the high density areas, yeah. Mm.
So, yeah, it's interesting how all that comes together. Now, something else I just wanted to touch on that's not directly related to that. You're talking about GE and Jack Welch.
Yep.
Just this week, too, the CEO of the REA Group has moved on. So, REA Group, owned by News Corp. So, she's been promoted.
You mean the owner of realestate.com?
Yeah, sorry, realestate.com. Yeah, I should clarify that. So, Tracy Fellows has been in the role for a few years, obviously done a really good job. And News Corp has said, right, we want you to go on to a bigger role of global real estate for all of News Corp. And I just wanted to touch on the two main players in Australia, because a lot of the time what we're dealing with in property and trying to make decisions about it is driven by the media and the hype and the perception.
Yep.
And there's two really big players when it comes to media influence, data, and if you're going to sell property, where you go to. So it's REA and Domain. Mm. Even what REA has, you know, just announced with her leaving, I thought I'd just give some listeners a little bit of background on those two in terms of size and how much they turn over. So REA is the dominant force by a long, long way.
By a mile.
Yeah, like Domain's well known, but REA is dominant. So as we said before, REA owned by News Corp. And Domain owned by Fairfax. So they've got big, powerful media houses behind them as well. Now, in terms of residential revenue growth, so their revenue from residential investors, you know, advertising with them. In 2018, the first half, realestate.com generated $324 million in revenue for that. By comparison, Domain, $86.1
million. Oh, wow. So there's a huge difference.
So it's massive. That's Australia-wide.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say that arguably the biggest player in the media space for Australian property would have to be REA, given the volume of eyeballs, the amount of dollars being spent there.
Yeah, most
that's definitely significant. Now, obviously, there's other players. I think CoreLogic are a big player because they're releasing data, but they're not always releasing opinions. They're releasing data based on facts as well.
And research.
How much does that translate into market influence, though? I mean, obviously, News Corp-owned company would then translate into News Corp newspapers.
Correct.
Writing things about the market.
Yeah.
But how does the revenue of realestate.com, where it's really just the eyeballs on the transactions of buying and selling, does that translate to a lot of people reading their blog articles and their other publications?
Look, I haven't got data to support that, but I believe yes. Because if you go to realestate.com or Domain at any time now, and you're there doing your own research on a house or looking for a property to rent, the website doesn't just show you that. They've got article advertisements and other things around it. Like,
that's
if you
true.
Go to The Age right now, and if you look under the property section, everything's Domain linked.
Mm. Yep.
So, you know, they're all closely intertwined. So they're both feeding off each other, you know, the assets
true.
That each group
has. And when you're looking at a particular listing on real estate or Domain, you'll see comparisons with local area, the median prices and data, and that will then take you to their resources.
Yes.
So you're in their network of of information.
Mm. Yeah.
Very interesting.
So they are, I would say they're two of the strongest influences in terms of public perception.
Mm. Something to think about. Mm. All right, well, we'll just head to another very, very quick break and we'll be back in a second.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back, guys. We're now heading on to the last member for our roundtable conversation, Louis. We're throwing over to you.
Yeah, I've got a really important topic today. I've been listening to the Black Eyed Peas' latest album.
Oh, right.
It's been out for a month.
That'd be crap.
And I'm happy to say they are going back to their roots.
Oh, Fergie's coming back.
No. No, I mean their actual roots.
Oh.
No, it's their seventh studio album. If you've followed their evolution over time, thanks, Brett, and were a true fan, you'd know that they started at the heart of hip-hop.
Well, it's obvious I'm not a true fan.
First two albums were heavily in hip-hop, and then this chick Fergie came along and they moved into the pop direction. Their third album, Ella Funk, was huge as a bit of a crossover hip-hop slash pop album.
Yep.
And then they got driven more in the pop direction as the commercial success kicked in and influenced their musical direction.
It's a very dedicated fan.
Fergie's out now,
and
they're back to hip-hop.
Okay, and you're happy about that?
And how are their sales since she's left?
I got no idea.
Okay.
Well, the thing with a band like the Black Eyed Peas is it probably doesn't matter what they release, they're going to sell a lot of albums.
Yeah.
They're just at that stage of their career.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my take on that is the Black Eyed Peas, because of their success, they now get to choose their path. So they could record, I don't know, they could go into Spanish Javiana music if they wanted to.
Yeah.
And they'd sell a lot of albums.
Yeah.
They've got the ability to choose their path. They could keep making pop music or they could go back to making hip-hop. And it starts to make me think about us and what we can learn from this in life and in finance. In life, we do go through different phases. We sometimes get to choose what our phase is and what our direction is, but we have periods of time where our earnings are low, particularly at the start of our career, and then our earnings go higher as our career develops, but then other life's circumstances happen, we start having families, maybe the family's income is halved for a period of time, and then it starts growing again, but also our expenses go from being low when we're younger to more expensive. Then we have a young family, which is more expensive, an old family, which is even more expensive, but then the kids leave home and it's less expensive again.
Hey.
But then we retire and travel and it's more expensive again. So how do you behave with your money as you go through these phases of life? You can be like the Black Eyed Peas and you can get pulled in the direction of wherever you're going, but there's points in your life where you can start to choose your own behavior and you can say, hang on, I know I've been going in this direction and that's been great, but why don't I choose to go in a different direction? And that's where we can choose our money habits. People tend to be influenced most by the money habits of their parents when they are younger.
Yeah.
So if you grew up in a family with affluent parents, you will either respond to that by living in a very similar manner or the complete opposite, generally speaking.
Yep. Yep.
And similar thing, if you grew up in a family that didn't have a lot of money in or even grew up in poverty, you will either grow up and have as an adult a very frugal mindset, or you will completely reject it and you will be a complete spender on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah, right.
If you grew up in a middle-class family, well, then you'll either be middle-class again or you'll do something the complete opposite. But that's if you are unconscious in how you behave. So I guess what I wanted to discuss was how you can be more open to choosing your path in future.
That's right. Okay. That sounds like great idea and great discussion.
So how is that then?
Well, the first step is awareness. To look at, well, what are my money habits? Do I spend lots on things that I don't actually need? Am I just in a habit of going out for breakfasts on a Saturday and Sunday morning?
Oh, no more smashed avocado.
And having smashed avocado, that comes up again. Great. Yeah. I didn't intend for that. But you get the idea. Like, is that really important to you? Like, we'll go out to a cafe and a breakfast for two people with coffees and things, you know, you could be looking at $60 for a breakfast. Do I really need to do that? Or was my $60 better spent elsewhere on something which I actually value more?
Mm.
Like if I didn't have breakfasts out for a month, then I've probably got enough saved to take a weekend holiday with my family.
Yeah.
It's almost like cigarette smoking as well. We've got a client that I've worked with here at UGC, and they were spending around about $20,000 a year on cigarettes.
Whoa.
And
20.
We had discussions around it, and they've given up.
Wow.
Good on them. And
not just for the financial reasons.
Not just for the financial reasons, also the health reasons as well. Yeah.
Yep.
What's he doing with his money? Is he investing it, Joel?
Yes. they're taking all of the necessary
and probably
steps.
Getting health insurance. Good on them.
So I think it's worthwhile being aware of your money history and also looking at your current money habits and reviewing whether those spending patterns are actually worthwhile for you in future or not.
Mm.
And make some decisions around choosing your future journey.
I think what you said, though, about, I mean, you go out for your breakfasts and you know, you could do something else with that money, but you just have to, as you said, have the awareness to actually put that money away and actually use it for another purpose, because often we don't use that and we just use it for something else. So you've got to be pretty careful about what you do with the rest of it. So.
True. I think the biggest challenge in our psychology with money is that people will generally spend up to their level of discomfort. And I've stolen that philosophy from someone else.
Yep.
Shout out to Ryan Gillespie. Thanks for that, my old mentor. And what I mean by that is people will think about their purchasing decisions, but ultimately they'll decide to spend their money on something until they get to the point of, oh shit, now I'm uncomfortable with how much money I spent. Now I'm going to stop spending until I get my next paycheck.
And then
they're comfortable to spend again until they reach their level of discomfort again. And if you can get out of that pattern, or if you can have a financial structure in place that is aware of that pattern and automatically puts money into the areas that it should go, like savings, investment, future planning, emergency fund, then you can still have that that cycle of spending to your level of discomfort, but you've already allocated money into those
elsewhere.
Different areas.
Correct.
And I think that's what, like you said about people that actually get pay increases, don't go and use that.
Yep.
Put it aside so that you're living as you were before the pay increase came
that's
through.
That's right, yeah. So a separate discussion is how your money should be structured to allow for those things. Today's discussion is around being aware of the psychological things, but maybe I'll bring up a topic again of what structure to actually have in place to manage that cash flow.
And being aware is quite difficult for a lot of people, Lou, because we're on autopilot and we can't see our own ways of doing things. It's almost like we need someone else to put us in check, or we need to be willing to take a step back to become aware.
Well, the card's always a problem too. A bit of plastic, give it over the counter and you don't even think about seeing the cash that's with it. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said for taking cash out in the week and only sticking to that budget.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
So is there a way people could sort of maybe give themselves an audit or a way of getting more aware?
Oh, well, yes, there is, but becoming self-aware is very different for each person. Mm. And there's being self-aware, but then there's really being self-aware. Mm. And how far do you want to take that? You could go to the Buddhist temples and discover true enlightenment for true self-awareness. Yep. How far do you want to take that? How long is a piece of string? But I guess the start is just having a certain amount of self-awareness.
Mm.
And an attitude of continual learning. I find the people who are successful in life are the ones who are willing to continually learn and continue to become more and more self-aware over time.
Success is not final and failure is not fatal.
Mm. And nice Louis, a while ago we touched on Stephen Covey's habits, and he talks about one philosophy I remember of the changes humans can make is in between the stimulus and the response. A lot of time a stimulus comes about, we automatically respond with what we're conditioned to do. Whereas if we have the awareness, we can stop between the stimulus and take a different response, make a conscious decision. So that's really what we're trying to figure out here.
In our habits, we are just pre-programmed because of our past experiences. When a certain event happens, we automatically respond almost without thinking. Sometimes we even think we're thinking about it, but we end up behaving the same way anyway. Mm. And you're right, Brett, there's no gap between the event happening and how we respond to it.
Mm.
And actually, the practice of meditating is, in a big way, learning to put a gap between that stimulus and your response. I'm a big advocate of meditating, not because I'm some hippie, but because I think there's real benefits to our psychology of having that practice.
Mm. And I'm hearing a lot more people saying the same thing, and there's a lot of apps now on you know, the iPhone or your smartphone that can help with that.
There is. Look, if meditating is good enough for elite sports people, from Dustin Martin to Michael Jordan, it's good enough for me.
Mm. Fair enough.
Yeah.
I must say I'm still a bit scarred by the Black Eyed Peas, though.
Yeah.
Well, don't you remember where they were last in Australia?
Yeah, the grand final.
Here we go.
Goddamn bloody grand final.
That's probably why I'm against them, is that day didn't work out the way it should have.
Louis got this habit of just bringing things back just to, you know.
He knows.
Yeah, he knows.
Just subtly bringing it back to that grand final day where, hang on, what happened again? Where the West Coast Eagles.
Yeah, it all started with the Black Eyed Peas, didn't it?
Getting off topic again, guys. But look, everyone should have a bit of a think and go on a bit of a money diet. And if that helps with the meditating, let's all give that a go. Now, just moving on, we're going to get to our last topic for the day, which is you can't be serious.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
Boys, who's got the topic to start with?
Where did you and Steph go on your first date, Joel?
Terra Rossa in Flinders Lane.
And were you able to stay there the whole time?
Yeah, we did.
We did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're a lot luckier than this boy I heard of in Scotland who was kicked out of the place he'd taken his first date.
Oh, okay.
How harsh is that?
What did he do?
Well, the problem was he was too young.
How old was he?
10.
Oh, man. I would have let him stay.
Okay, but the place was Nando's.
He got kicked out of Nando's, taking
a girl on a date as a 10-year-old. And the reason being is Nando's have a strict philosophy that no one under 13 can be there unless accompanied by an adult.
Oh, wow.
Did they check his ID?
Didn't see how that came about.
Goodness.
But anyway, maybe better luck with McDonald's or something next time.
I think that's pretty cute. What a Casanova.
He's trying to be upmarket. Don't take it at Macca's. Take it at Nando's.
Yeah.
I've got one, and I can sympathise with this guy. So a New Jersey man, Christopher Grayshock, 57, over in the US, was caught drink driving. And his excuse was, the New York Jets are just shit.
True.
he should take a day in our lives where Collingwood are in a grand final once every 3 years and lose... 2 out of every 3.
Yeah. Well, Joel, was it just the Jets or did you also say the Giants?
Well, the Giants are shit as well.
New York football.
I'm going to make Gary Vaynerchuk.
And another man in Mississippi, Keith Cavalier. He was caught crashing his car into the Harrison County Courthouse on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was because he wanted to alert the authorities that his drug paraphernalia had been stolen.
Are you serious?
Doesn't sound like the brightest spark.
I can think of better ways to capture the law's attention.
Jeez. Guys, you're all missing the biggest news of the week.
Oh.
And it's Bunnings onions.
Oh.
You cannot be serious.
I did hear this.
Seriously? Yeah. So Bunnings have introduced a policy for the charity sellers of onion,
when you go and get your sausages,
of hot dogs,
yep.
When you walk into a Bunnings store, it's now official policy that the onions are not allowed to be placed on top of the sausage,
what?
Because they may fall out onto the floor of the Bunnings store. And someone may trip over them.
Wow, that's taking safety to a new level.
Safety to a new level. But hang on. Everyone has weighed in on this.
Absolutely.
Of course, Twitter's gone berserk about it. But it's in the mainstream so much that the Prime Minister was asked about it, who says he's going to buy sausage and bread, no matter what form it comes in.
Mm.
Look, I don't like laughing at people's... misfortunes, but turns out there is someone who was actually seriously affected by this. His name's Trevor. His actual name can't be revealed because of a non-disclosure agreement with Bunnings.
But he actually
tripped over an onion in a Bunnings store.
Was it from his own sausage?
So, quoting Trevor, I walked into the store and it happened so fast. I'd leather boots on. I went down on my back.
Poor guy.
I went to I went to another Bunnings a couple of weeks after and I had a panic attack.
Give yourself an uppercut.
But I'm just not sure that having onions underneath is going to change anything.
Nah. That is un-Australian.
Every time I go into Bunnings now, I look on the floor, I look for onions.
Next time I go, I'll still be asking for them on top.
Look, the thing is, I'm going to have. I eat it before I get into the store anyway, so it's not going to affect anyone if it's mine.
We are such a nanny state. I mean, before you know it, they're going to be banning onions, and then they're going to ban the goddamn bloody sausage and bread.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, guys, because we're out of time. We'll bring the onions up next week.
Sorry, Trevor.
But thanks, guys, for all your input today, and thanks for our listeners for tuning in, and we'll be back next week. Okay. Have a great Friday, guys.
Thanks, Steph.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au. And follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.